This episode is brought to you by GBN University, powered by Golf Business Network. GBNU is where PGA professionals come to improve their skills, build their careers, and increase their impact. Go to golfbusinessnetwork.com/GBNUniversity for more info. This is the Getting Better Now podcast, and I'm your host, Dean Campbell. If you've been listening for a while, you've come to understand how important I believe leadership is to being a successful PGA professional. In these times of low retention levels and poor employee engagement, your ability to lead your team and your facility has never been more critical. It's the reason we're launching a much-anticipated leadership program from GBNU here this fall 2022. We're going to give PGA professionals the chance to develop their leadership skills so they can become somebody that people want to follow, somebody that people want to work for, and somebody that can produce results for their facility, all through the lens of what you, the PGA professional, do every day. I can't wait to tell you more about it. Stay tuned. And right on cue, we have an episode that can be a masterclass on leadership. I was so honored to have the chance to speak with our featured guest, David Novak. David is one of the premier leadership minds out there. He's the former CEO and co-founder of Yum Brands, which operates KFC, Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, and The Habit Burger. He's been named Chief Executive of the Year and oversaw explosive growth as the company doubled its number of restaurants under his leadership and grew to a market cap of almost $32 billion. His marketing background includes such big wins as developing and launching Cool Ranch Doritos and Pizza Hut's Meat Lovers Pizza, along with one notable marketing mishap, which we'll discuss. You won't want to miss that. Now, after retiring in 2016, David launched David Novak Leadership, where he coaches leaders using his time-tested methods and practices, including purposeful recognition, which we'll talk about in this episode. He's the host of the very popular How Leaders Lead podcast, where he talks with world-class leaders every week. In addition, he's a New York Times best-selling author. So David is busy these days, to say the least, but not too busy to find time for one of his biggest passions, and that's golf. He's the definition of a golf nut, and not to mention quite a player. You'll hear early in our conversation about a huge accomplishment he achieved this summer. So David knows golf, and he knows golf pros. That's why this conversation is so powerful. Whether you're in a leadership position or aspire to get to one, David's lessons here are priceless and ones you can implement the very next time you walk in the door at work. This was such a pleasure to have this conversation, and I'm excited to share it with you. Here it is, my conversation with David Novak. I hope you enjoy it. David, I really thank you for taking some time to chat with us today. This is going to be an exciting conversation. I'm looking forward to it. I'm a big fan of yours. Been listening to your podcast for a long time. I've learned a lot from it. So selfishly, I get to sit with you for a little bit this morning and talk to you. So this is exciting for me, and I know the audience is going to get a lot from it as well.
I'm very excited to be with you. So thanks for having me. It's an honor.
All right. So generally, we start out, on a lot of podcasts, we start out, you know, tell us about your background, how you got to where you are, or tell us your career. But I'm going to ask you what I think is probably a more important question for you. How's your golf game these days?
You know, my golf game has never been better. I am playing so well. I'm 69 years old, and I just won the regular club championship for Shinnecock.
Congratulations.
I'm the oldest guy to ever win it, and it wasn't the senior club championship. I had to beat some young bucks out there.
I bet.
but I took them down, and it was great. But I'm having an unbelievably good golf summer. For some reason, everything's really clicking, and I'm sort of on a roll, and I'm kind of pinching myself. So thanks for asking. I like telling everybody that.
Yeah, I bet. Any dramatic stories from maybe the final or the club championship there? I assume, was it a match play final? Was it a stroke play championship?
It was a match play final. Yeah. You know, I was playing a two-time club championship. Cy Anthony, he's a two-time club champion, and you know, he's a very good golfer. I think he's a scratch to plus two. But I closed him out on the 15th hole, and I could have done it earlier if I wouldn't have three putted, you know, a couple of holes. So, but I just, it was one of those days where I didn't miss a shot.
Yeah,
you know, I was, I think I played, you know, I was even par or one over, you know, in the front nine, and just, it was fun. So I could go on and on and talk about it. You don't want to hear any more than that. You know, the worst thing you can have is these guys tell you about every hole.
Right. Hey, listen, all my days working in the golf shop, you know, I've heard it all, you know, yeah. So, and we always know, you'd ask, hey, how'd you play, you know, and yeah. Listen to the stories. But I know I wanted to give you a little bit of time to gloat there. That's a great accomplishment. So,
you know, I'm a real fan of PGA pros, and I always tell everybody I'm a PGA pros dream because I don't like to hit golf balls alone. You know,
right.
So I'm always, you know, trying to learn from everybody, and I appreciate all that you and your team does.
Thank you. Well, let me ask you a question about PGA pros then, and this might be kind of put you on the spot a little bit, but you've been around a lot of them. You know, you played a lot of great places, and obviously you've experienced some great PGA professionals. When you think of the pros that stick out in your mind that you've been around, what do you think are some of the traits that you think have that kind of appeal to you, or that make a great PGA professional in your mind?
Well, I think a great PGA professional obviously is a great teacher. They know their trade. You know, so they can really help you get better at your game. But I think what really separates the good from, or the great from the good, is the genuine interest that the pro takes in your development. Mm-hmm. And you can't really fake it. You know, they're out there. They really care about you doing better. They're rooting for you to do better. And it's that interest that I think really separates the great pros. The other thing is that the great pros build great teams. You know, when I think of the consummate club professional, I think of Bob Ford. I mean, Bob mm-hmm. Ford has placed, he's like the Johnny Wooden of professional golf. I mean, he's placed more assistants into head pro jobs than anybody in the world.
Right.
But he teaches people how to be a pro. You know, how to dress, how to act around members, how to take that active interest, how to be proactive, how not to just sit around, you know. But, you know, if a guy's out there putting and you've got somebody else covering the shot, go out there and talk to him. And, yeah. You know, give them a little bit of free advice every now and then. You know, it's just, you know, it's that, those little tricks of the trade, you know, Bob really knows well. And, you know, I see that now in Matt Cahill at Seminole. And, you know, another great pro that I absolutely love is Craig Harmon at MacArthur. Mm-hmm. I mean, that guy, he just really cares about his students, you know, and yeah. You know, no one will care about you until you care about them. And I think that's a leadership maxim, and the best pros do that.
Well, and it leads right into what makes a great leader. You know, I've heard you talk about, you know, and we're going to get into recognition and kind of explain how you utilize that as a leader. But you can't be a great leader without showing your team that you care either, can you?
Absolutely. You know, I learned that by, you know, learning about Sam Walton. And, you know, and he was a big believer in showing people that he really believed in him. And the way how he did it is he thought the more you know, the more you care. Mm-hmm. And so he shared everything that he knew about what was going on at Walmart with his associates, because he knew that if they knew what he knew, they would care more. And I think that's true with head pros as well. You know, too many times, professional just gets in their own cocoon. You know, I've seen this. They think, they just do their job. you know, they're kind of maybe a little bit introverted in the way how they manage, but they don't they don't really build up their team members and grow their team members. And, you know, I think you have to, and one of the great ways that you can do that is to let everybody know how your club is doing, you know, how many rounds you have, you know, what the guests are basically telling us, you know, just, but get people involved in what's really going on and let them know what you know, and they're going to care more.
Mm-hmm. How did you implement that in some of, in your time as a leader, whether it was, I've heard you talking about having to turn around KFC, or, you know, when you got to Pizza Hut earlier in your career and you had to make some changes there, were those kind of tactics that you used to kind of build up the culture by getting people involved that way?
The first thing that I always did in situations like that is to define reality. You know, and that means that you really got to understand how the business is performing. So I would try to define the reality basis, all the research, what I was hearing from team members, what I was learning on the front line. Then I would bring my team together and say, hey, this is the reality that I see. How do you see it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, many times they would say, hey, I think this is exactly what we're facing. Or they might give you a couple things that you hadn't really thought of or considered. And then you ask the important question, which is, okay, what would you do if you were running the place? And right. And you get people to really give you their feedback on what they would do if they were running your shop or whatever. And you know, I think that's a way to really get people involved. And then I think the other thing that a leader has to do is Napoleon said leaders are dealers in hope. Okay. You got to give people a vision and a hope that you, no matter how good you are right now, you can get better by doing these things. And if you can develop that plan together with your team, you are on your way.
Right. So is that like defining your values as a team? Would you say that's part of that process of getting everybody on board? And really then the leader and the team really living out those values? Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, I did sort of a mini case history that I think is very relevant to you and your organization. You know, I went in with three other guys and we bought Valhalla, okay, which is the, you know, three-time side of the PGA Championship Ryder Cup venue, and we've got the 2024 Ryder Cup or 2024 PGA coming up. And so, you know, I got the owners together along with the staff. We defined reality. Everybody agreed on what the reality was. Then we said, okay, what's our mission going to be? Mm-hmm. And we agreed what our mission was going to be. And then, you know, we talked about what our key strategies was going to be, what we were going to do. And in this particular case, we want to turn Valhalla into a tremendous Kentucky experience, you know. And so, you know, we've got all kinds of ideas on how to do that. And we're going to really transform the place. But then we did talk about values. And I don't really like values as a phrase. You know, I like behaviors. It's more of like, what behaviors do we want to exhibit as owners and as a team to demonstrate to our members and our guests that, you know, we're committed to excellence. And so we identified what those behaviors are, which, you know, you could call them values, behaviors, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then we said, okay, these are the things we want to recognize in when we see it. And that's what I call purposeful recognition. You know, every team should really identify what behaviors they think is important to their success. And then when you see people doing those behaviors, it could be focusing on a guest or whatever, and doing a really good job with that, or being proactive and doing something without somebody telling you, taking the initiative. When people do those things, recognize those things when you see them, because one thing is a proven fact: people will do more of what they get recognized for. And that's why I think every leader should really identify the behaviors that will drive success and then recognize those behaviors when they see them. And that's what I call purposeful recognition.
So then recognizing what you want to see, would you say that's more powerful than correcting or pointing out things that you don't want to see when you see them happen.
Well, I think recognizing the good behaviors is more powerful. But one of the things that, and it has to be earned. You just can't recognize people just to be a good person. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have to see people actually get it done. But the other part of a leader is you have to recognize bad behavior. When you have somebody that's doing something that's inconsistent with the behaviors that you know that will drive success, you got to call them out and give them some mm-hmm. coaching and, you know, make sure that they are aware of the fact that they're letting the team down. So, people have always called me sort of like I come off at times as a teddy bear, but I can be a grizzly bear. And I think that's what, you know, every leader has to do. You got to really get good at the soft stuff, you know, empathy, collaboration, showing people you care, because that really drives the hard results. But, you know, when people are doing things that are counterproductive, then you got to turn into that grizzly bear and let people know that that's just not the way we do things here.
Did you have a process for that? I don't want to focus on the negative, but now I'm asking selfishly, you know, because I feel like as a manager or leader, I might've been all over the place with maybe one day I would be willing to jump on somebody the first time I saw something happen. And then other times I might let it go for a little while. And that didn't work out that well either. Did you have a process, you know, or just something you try to stick to as far as when you would point something out or maybe bring somebody in? Did it have to get to a certain level before you addressed it?
I think you have to be aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
And then when you see someone who is being counterproductive, I've never been one to wait till the next day to tell them. Mm-hmm. I'm one that when you see it, make it real time, go up and tell them what you saw so you can all agree on what happened. Okay. And then give the person the coaching they need to get better. You know, don't let somebody flail around for 4 or 5 days before you get enough courage to really address the conflict. You know, if I ask, there are 100 people in the room and I ask them, how many of you love conflict? Nobody would raise their hand. You know, one of the biggest problems that leaders have is not really dealing with conflict in a productive fashion. And, you know, I really think it's the leader's job to not only identify conflicts and then address it, but sniff out conflict, sniff out potential areas of conflict and be proactive so that the conflicts sometimes don't have to take place.
Mm-hmm. So then let's talk about the good stuff with recognition. You've become known for that. You teach on it all the time about recognition. How did that become a regular part of your leadership practice?
Well, I think my parents always recognized me. You know, they gave me a lot of love. And, you know, I think so that may have been just part of my DNA. But when I was with Pepsi-Cola Company, I ran operations and I used to go out in the field and go to the bottling plants and talk to the people closest to the customers and ask them what was working, what's not working. And so I go to St. Louis and I have this round table at 6 o'clock in the morning, buy everybody coffee and donuts. They come in and we start talking to a group of route salesmen. And these are people who drive the Pepsi trucks and make sure that the merchandising's right, the POP's up properly, et cetera. And I said, hey, tell me about merchandising. What have you learned about merchandising lately? And everybody started raving about this guy named Bob, who's sitting directly across the table from me. And they say, oh, man, if you want to know about merchandising, talk to Bob. He's an expert at it. You should see him with customers. He knows how to get the facings just right. He knows how to get, you know, more displays up. I mean, this guy is amazing. Yeah, oh, Bob, he taught me more in, you know, 4 hours than I learned my first 2 years when I was at Pepsi. He's amazing. And so I look down across the table, and he's crying. And I said, Bob, these guys are heaping all this praise on you and you're crying. And he said, well, David, I've been in this company for 47 years. I'm retiring in 2 weeks. And I didn't know that people felt this way about me. And that hit me in the gut. And I said to myself as a leader, from that day forward, I was going to make recognition the number one value that I would have in whatever organization I had the privilege of leading. And because I thought, geez, this guy is so good. He doesn't feel appreciated for what he does. And he's so great at what he does he could actually done more if people would have really kept their eye out and recognized him for what he was and given him even more responsibility. And so from that day forward, I made recognition my number one tenet in terms of how I lead and trying to make sure that I recognize people who earn it. You know, that's mm-hmm. I can't underestimate that fact. You know, you just can't go around just telling everybody how good they are. You got to go around telling everybody what they did that makes them good. And that right. earned recognition is key.
So you make it specific. Did you have a process, though, for making sure that you were recognizing people on a regular basis? Or, you know, did you have to build it into your process or schedule yeah. or it just happened?
Well, you know, I had... My belief is spontaneous recognition is the most important thing you can do. Mm-hmm. And so I looked for people to recognize. You know,
okay.
Colin Powell once told me, he said when he worked in a bottling plant at Pepsi, he mopped up the syrup every day, and the foreman came to talk to him at the end of the summer and said, "Son, you've been doing a really great job." And he said, that's when he really realized the power of recognition. It says somebody's watching. So my process is look out for it. You know, sure. when you see people doing something, then recognize them. Now, I had a lot of fun with recognition. Like when I was president of KFC, I gave away a rubber chicken, a floppy chicken. When I was president of Pizza, I gave away a cheesehead. When I was CEO of Yum Brands, I gave away these Walk the Talk Deep, you know. And what I would do is make it very personalized. I would number each one of them. I would write on each one what that person did. And then I would take a picture of them and tell them that I'm going to send them a framed copy of this picture. They can throw it in the trash if they want, but their picture is going to go up in my office. And because what they do is what makes our business tick. And I appreciate everything that you do. And that was my process for how I recognize. I think the more personal you can make it, the more fun you can have doing it, the better. You know, I did fill my office up with people that I've recognized. If you go on my Twitter, David Novak Ogo, you can see a video of my office where I have people that I've recognized from floor to ceiling and then on the ceiling, you know, and it's really fun because it's people that is what makes our business tick. Now, the other part of my process was, you know, we had more formal recognition. Okay. You know, like the annual recognition awards, you know, where, you know, we would recognize the highest performers, you know, and you know, that kind of formal recognition is important. But why do you want to wait till the end of the year to recognize your people? Make it a part of your day-to-day activity. And once you start recognizing people, I mean, it's like it catches fire. And what was interesting, once I showed people how to do recognition and how much fun it could be, everybody else started coming up with their individual recognition awards and having a lot of fun doing it. And it spread all around the world, which is, and today, if you ask the people at Yum, I went back at our 25th anniversary, they had me come in and speak. Everybody told me the single thing that makes the culture of Yum great is the recognition that we exhibit around the world. So this stuff really works, and it works everywhere.
So it literally formed the culture there at Yum Brands as a culture of recognition that's still going on to this day. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's been written about by a lot of, you know, Fortune did a big article on us. You know, we've had all kinds of recognition. My goal was to make recognition such a big success factor for our company and get great success. And unfortunately, our company did have a lot of success. You know, our stock went up about 8 times, you know, now it's like 10 times. And, you know, so that people would want to understand why, and they would best practice us and try to learn how we did recognition so well. And, you know, I'm really pleased to say we've had a lot of great companies come in and try to learn from us now, which is great because I always went to them and learned from them on what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking about the power of this. And so in these last few podcasts or number of podcasts I've been doing this year, we keep talking about this labor crisis in golf, and it's throughout many industries, all of hospitality and your former industry. But I'm thinking about our challenges with retention, really. You know, when we get people in, how are we going to keep them? I bet you would say this is a pretty key retention strategy when it comes to keeping good people.
Absolutely. There are two reasons why people leave. and this has been quantified time and time again by a lot of big companies and a lot of associations. Number one, people don't get along with their boss. Number two, they don't feel appreciated for what they do. Usually these are part and parcel. They're linked to each other.
Right.
The boss doesn't make people feel appreciated and therefore they leave. So what I think you need to see yourself as is not a boss. Boss is a 1950s, you know, it's the old line way of thinking about leadership. See right. yourself as a coach, and coaches develop you and help you become the best you can be. And then, you know, appreciate people when you see them doing good things. And that recognition will pay off. And, you know, I always felt like in our business that the restaurant general manager was the most important leader because they built the teams that satisfied the customers. And if you had mm-hmm. a great restaurant manager, you always had a good business. I always say, show me a good leader and I'll show you a good business. And that's true in the golf world too.
Yeah.
You know, show me a well-run, you know, professional shop and I guarantee you there's a great professional there. And the best ones, they coach their people. They're not telling them what to do. They coach people into success. And the best ones recognize people when they do a good job. And, you know, that permeates and spreads throughout the organization. And even with your membership and your guests.
Well, and you're just reiterating a point that I love when I hear somebody, you know, of your experience and your knowledge make a point like that. You know, we can help solve these issues we have in the golf industry through great leadership. And we can make being a golf pro and a PGA professional and club pro a great job, right? We need help of the members and the clubs and the mm-hmm. owners. But the head pros, directors of golf, general managers, through great leadership, we can keep great people and make being in the golf business, a good place to be.
Well, let me ask you, who wants to work for a jerk?
Right.
Okay. Who wants to work for someone that doesn't take interest in them?
Right.
Who wants to work for someone when you bust your ass, people don't notice it. They just take it for granted. No one. Right. And so, you know what? There are so many jerks out there, so many people not doing things well, that if you do it well, you can be a magnet for great talent.
Yeah.
And I think you can't be a victim. You have to say, okay, I'm going to create the work environment that's so good that people are going to want to work for me and want to work at our club.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like saying if people don't understand the value of a great leader, put a bad leader in there and see what happens.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And then you'll see what a great leader can do.
I've seen a bad leader be successful for a year, maybe, but I've never seen a bad leader ever get sustainable results.
Yeah.
You know, I might get lucky, but it's not going to last for very long.
And you mentioned coaching originally when my first question about PGA professionals and what you thought were great PGA professionals. You said the you were taken from a coaching standpoint, the ones that have coached you on your game, they take interest, they care, you know, they check in on you. And that now come in full circle, a great head pro is a great coach to their team who checks in on them, cares about them, makes sure that they're progressing in their careers, just like they're making sure you're progressing in your golf game.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. You summed it up perfectly.
So that's coaching others. One of your specialties and topics that you're talking a lot about now through your new book is self-coaching. And this correlates great with golf. I think all of our listeners here are going to understand this really coming from a golf perspective. And then you can help us correlate this into how we can help us on the job through self-coaching. So talk to us about the definition of self-coaching and how you've used it.
Well, thanks for bringing up my book. It's called Take Charge of You, How Self-Coaching Can Transform Your Life and Career. And it's just getting rave reviews. And I think it's because it's so well-timed. You know, your life is way too important. Your career is way too important to delegate it to someone else. You need to take accountability and ownership of your own development. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get coaching from other people, but it means that you have to go through the process of having a real conversation with yourself and really asking yourself some key questions and building self-awareness. You know, like one of the things I really believe, Dean, that, you know, people need to understand is what blocks your joy? What gets in the way of the joy that you have? And then, you know, write all those things down, and then write down what gives you joy. What's the joy builders? And write all those down. So if you look at how you're going about your work and what you're doing at work, and you're spending more time on the joy blockers than the joy builders, then you got a problem, and you got to take accountability for really figuring out how you can be spending more time doing what you love and doing the things that will give you the maximum in your life. You know, one of my good friends is Warren Buffett, you know, and I used to go see him every year, and he wrote a book that was entitled, his autobiography was Tap Dance to Work. You know, and it was because he loved his job, because he was spending time doing the things that gives him joy. He loved investing. He loved, you know, he loved doing learning about business. He loved being around people. You know, if you're a golf pro, you know, the good news is you're usually in something that you really love.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, that's great. You're already in the right position. And then what you have to do is really understand how to maximize what you do so that you can grow and make your club as good as it can be. And I think in most cases, I think for the golf pro, it's leveraging their strengths and their passion for the game, but being very mindful of who they are as an individual, you know, what being highly self-aware of what the areas of opportunity are for you. And, you know, I think that that's a great thing to go through, a great process to go through. One of the things I do every year, Dean, is I do what I call 3x5 exercise. I write down everything that I am today, you know, the 4 or 5 things that I am today. And then I write down what I need to be tomorrow to be a better person, a better leader. Okay. And that gives me my roadmap for that year. Okay. Like in golf, it might be, you know, I got a great full swing, but I got to get better at the short game, you know, and that's sort of in the area of physical, but, right. You know, then I put that on my refrigerator and I look at it every day. It keeps it top of mind, but self-awareness is critical. Every leader has high self-awareness and really determines what they have to do to take their performance to the next level.
How did you become more self-aware? What can we do if it's about really understanding our strengths and weaknesses and how we come off to people to become more self-aware? That's at least how I understand it. What do you think we could do to grow in that area?
Well, the first thing is you really have to want to know it.
Mm-hmm.
You have
it
to deal
tough
with
to hear, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so the way how you do it, it's not that complicated. Just go around your members that you respect, your team members, and ask them how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're all going to say, oh, you're doing great. Well, then ask them again. And they say, oh, you're doing great. Then ask them one more time. And they say, well, you might want to do this. Okay. So you got to push for it. Ask at least 3 times. And then you'll start to peel the onion back and you'll figure out what you can do better.
Yeah.
And then ask people what they would do if they were you. And then really be open to this. Don't be sensitive to it. Be vulnerable enough to ask and be vulnerable enough to listen. And, you know, I think that's how you begin to build self-awareness. You know, a lot of big companies have 360-degree feedback and all. You're not going to have that in most golf shops. But you do have your membership. You have your membership. You have your team members. And you have people who can give you the feedback that you need. But you got to want it.
Yeah. And it's so easy to put off or avoid. I mean, I did a formal 360 with my team about halfway into my tenure as a head golf professional. And it was eye-opening. I would say it transformed how I led because I took the, you know, I had to see the criticism and take it and, you know, decided to respond to it. But surveying members as well. We did plenty of anonymous surveys about the service levels we were putting out. And you see, you know, get some negative comments about the job that I was doing as the head pro. And you got to, you know, you can either, it's like fight or flight. You either take it and use it to improve or.
Don't really. I would encourage everybody not to look at it as criticism, but look at it as feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. you know, we all get our the hair up on our back when we hear the things that we could potentially do better. But, you know, that's what I mean. You got to really want it.
Yeah.
Okay. And once you get the feedback and you get a self-assessment, you build your self-awareness of where you're at with the leader, then, you know, one of the things that I think you have to do is you have to have your self-coaching plan. You got to understand what that transformational insight is that's going to take your performance to the next level, and then figure out how you're going to get it done, how you're going to get better at it, and to put some specific actions down that you're going to do to get there.
And, you know, as golfers, you know, we're golf pros, but we're golfers first and foremost. A lot of us have done this with our golf game, right? You may know, hey, I'm a good driver. I hit it down the middle and I hit, you know, enough greens, but, you know, I don't putt as well as I should. Right.
Right.
That's no different than saying, hey, I'm good at the financials, but I'm not, you know, as good at recognizing my team. Right.
Absolutely. You know, you have high self-awareness of your golf game, you know, transfer that into your people and your business. And I guarantee you, you'll be a much better leader.
Mm-hmm. How have you used self-coaching? What's been the benefit for you? I know you've used it in your golf game, and going back to our first conversation, it's working, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like in golf, you know, I've really spent a lot of time on my short game, particularly putting, you know, and pitching, but my putting has improved dramatically. But I got some real expertise on how to improve my lag putting and my, and then I do a drill that I know the pros do: 5 feet, 10 feet, 15 feet, 20 feet, keep track, do it five times, five different locations. Mm-hmm. If you score 100, you're in the top 10 of strokes gained putting for professionals, you know, so, you know, that's a great drill to do. So yeah, I did that, you know, but I told you, you know, I go through that 3x5 exercise every year. Yeah. You know, that's really something that I do. But I'm constantly asking people for feedback on my podcast. What do you like about it? You know, like, here's a good self-awareness. You know, I originally started doing my podcast, but I didn't have a controlling idea. And what I learned by talking to people was that people want to know what they're going to get out of the podcast before they get into it. So I start out every one of my podcasts with a controlling idea. And then, you know, you'll pick that up as you go through the podcast itself. And then one of the things I heard was that people said they wanted to learn more from me. So I started a new podcast. I post a podcast with a CEO or a leader every Thursday. And then on Monday, I now have a new podcast, and my podcast is How Leaders Lead with David Novak. Then on Monday, what I have is a How Leaders Lead with David Novak, three questions. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I have this woman, Kula Coulihan, who asked me three questions about my guest the prior week.
Yeah.
It's a 15-minute podcast, but this way I'm able to share with people, you know, what I've learned. That's how I'm kind of improving my business in terms of, you know, my own personal leadership style. I'm extremely passionate about what I do. And when you have power and you have leadership and your passion, you can overwhelm people. So I tell everybody, hey, I know I'm can be overwhelming. Save me from myself. Don't let me do that. Catch me, you know, let me know when I'm getting too enthusiastic. Because I need to have more tempered enthusiasm and tempered passion. So it's a great strength of mine, but it can intimidate people if I don't put it in the proper balance.
One of the things that you talk about in the self-coaching is really defining your purpose. And this is part of coaching yourself and understanding that. That could be a challenge for people. It just seems like, oh, the purpose, that's this big pie in the sky kind of thing. You know, how can we go about defining our purpose, and what would the benefit be?
Yeah. Well, I think the best way to do it is to really understand what gives you joy.
Mm-hmm.
And like we were talking about earlier, once you understand what gives you joy, then you might be able to tap dance to work. Okay. And then you can have a purpose. You know, what gives me joy, for example, is I love leadership development. So my passion is to make the world a better place by developing better leaders. I mean, that's why I do my podcast. That's why I do my digital leadership training. That's why I write my books. It's all geared towards making the world a better place by developing better leaders. But it gives me joy. It's my purpose, right? You know, and so I'm spending time doing something that I really need. So I can't overemphasize the importance of really understanding who you are and what gives you joy. Now, why is it so important? Okay. It's because it gives you satisfaction. You know, it gives you the reason why you go to work. Okay. The most important thing you can take to work is a reason why. Okay. And it gives you sort of a higher calling for what you do. And I think that's magic in the bottle when you can catch it. A lot of people say, well, how do you do that? I mean, it's so hard. It's easy for you to say, and you're right, but you got to stay after it. Yeah. You know, it's like, keep asking yourself these questions, you know, keep probing and listening to the truth about yourself and what really makes you tick. And maybe you shouldn't be a golf pro. Maybe you don't have a lot of joy there. But God, you sure have loved learning about accounting and finance and whatever. So then maybe you need to move into that area. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you, when you end up focusing on something that you love, that'll give you that purpose that you really need, that reason why, that I think really can help you be successful. I don't know about you, but I'm not very, you know, I don't really like things that I'm not that good at.
Right. Most people don't. Right?
Most people don't. Okay. So the more you can leverage your strengths, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. If you like something that you're not very good at, that's a hobby. That's not going to be your job probably for your career. Right. Yeah,
absolutely. Right.
Yeah. I've heard Marcus Buckingham talk about, you know, finding your purpose and you know, thinking about those days where you walked out of work and, you know, the day flew by. What was the last time, you know, you walked out of, you know, for our audience, walked out of the club and just, you weren't looking at the clock, you know, and you were looking forward to coming back the next day. What happened that day?
Yeah.
Right. That you can look at and maybe try to replicate or repeat more often.
Yeah. Well, I think that's that why you look at what gives you joy.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I'm really fortunate now. First of all, I've been blessed for a long time, but when I was running Yum Brands, the three things that I love more than anything is people, food, and marketing. Mm-hmm. And those were the three things that I spent the most time on. And so when I went to work every day, you know, I really was trying to focus on those three things. And, you know, when I came home, I had a great day. You know, now there are times when I'd have some things that come up and be joy blockers that you have to deal with. But the majority of my time was around those three things. Now that I'm sort of moving on to my second chapter of my career, the three things that I'm focused on are leadership development, my family. You know, I've got three beautiful grandkids and, you know, one daughter, and, you know, my wife and I are celebrating our 48th wedding anniversary this year. And so I focus on leadership development, my family, and golf. Mm-hmm. And anything that gets in the way of those three things, I say no to. Now, I know that I'm a very blessed guy to be able to do that, but, you know, I'm 69. It's okay. You know,
you put in your time.
I put in my time, and you know, and I'm going to go till I'm hopefully 100 or so. But you know, but I think that the time I'm spending now, Dean, is really, really powerful because I'm spending it on what I love, and I'm spending on what really gives me joy. And this leadership development stuff I do is incredible. I mean, I love doing my podcast. You know, I just did a podcast with Roger Goodell. You know, I just did a podcast with, you know, just, you know, I've got one coming up with Peyton Manning. You know, I've got a podcast coming up with Stanley Druckenmiller. That's going to be, he's the leading investor of all time. He's got a better record than Warren Buffett, for example. You know, but every time I do these, I have to learn, and I love learning. That's a big thing that gives me joy, is I love learning. And so, you know, doing these podcasts is really fantastic. And I want to grow the podcast to make it as good as it can possibly be.
Well, I'm with you on that, on the, you know, the excitement of the podcast and being able to learn from people every time you do an episode, no matter who it is. And, you know, this is certainly an example of that on my end. But you talked about marketing, and your background was in marketing before you got into operations and CEO. I've heard you talk several times about one really big win that you had I'm sure you had more, but one really big notable win you had as a marketer, and one really notable, it wasn't a win, as a marketer. I was, as a child of the 90s, I remember both of these, and, first one, the win, we'll talk about that first, the Cool Ranch Doritos. I've had plenty of those. In my life. About how that came about.
I was working with Frito-Lay, and Frito-Lay really is a fantastic company. Doritos is a big brand. Nacho Cheese Doritos was their big seller, but the business was starting to slow down a little bit. But when I looked at the business, product news always is powerful when you can bring forward new ideas. So I said, I think we need a new line extension. Doritos started out with toasted corn Doritos. Then they launched nacho cheese Doritos. They had taco Doritos. Nacho cheese was the big hit. So I said, we need another flavor idea. So I took my team to the grocery aisle. I said, let's just go look and see what's going on in the grocery stores and see if there's anything that we can pick up. And when we got to the salad dressing aisle, what we learned was that the salad dressing was that was growing the fastest was ranch flavor. And so I came back and I said, why don't we develop a ranch flavored Dorito? So I called the R&D, had Dennis Hurd of Frito-Lay, and said, hey, do you think we could make a ranch flavored Dorito? He says, yeah, that'd be terrific. And so that's what we did. And we learned from nacho cheese Doritos, you need to have a unique image to a known quantity. Nacho cheese was called nacho cheese, and that was the unique image. So we had ranch dressing, so we called it Cool Ranch Doritos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the rest is history. It's one of the most profitable, biggest selling snack chips in the world today. And I've had a lot of them myself. That was great. Now, I think you're referring to my negative thing that happened was I was also the inventor of Crystal Pepsi, which was a clear Pepsi-Cola product. There's a great example of where I didn't get the right people involved and really didn't look at the barriers enough. You know, the franchisees told me that this is a great idea, but they said it needed to taste more like Pepsi, and I didn't listen to them. I was a heat-seeking missile. I wanted to get it into the marketplace, and we launched it. And it was the most the only product in Pepsi-Cola's history, which was introduced at a carbonated soft drink that was introduced at a premium price. And I asked the bottlers, I said, why are you charging so much for this? And they said, well, we know everybody's going to try it, but they're not going to come back and buy it again. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, because it doesn't taste enough like Pepsi. So we launched the product, and guess what? Everybody tried it.
Everybody did try it.
It was a sensation, but the bottlers were right. They didn't come back and buy it again, because guess what? The number one reason was that they didn't buy it again. Didn't taste enough like Pepsi. So by the way, that product the previous year when it was in test market, when we put it into Boulder, Colorado, the first day it came off the lines in the bottling plant, it was listed, or Dan Rather did, it was the lead story in CBS News that evening. Today in Boulder, Colorado, Pepsi-Cola launched a clear Pepsi, Crystal Pepsi, you know. And I'm thinking, man, this is great. And then it was named one of the top 10 innovations of that year. In the year 2000, Time Magazine listed as one of the top 10 marketing failures of the last century. I survived it all. But yeah. I think one of the reasons was everybody made a lot of money on it because they priced it so high, and it actually helped us make plan and, you know, have a good year. But what makes me sick about it, Dean, is that it could have been so much better. It was a great idea poorly executed. And that's usually what happens, you know, is that you can have a great idea, but if you don't execute it well, that's a huge disappointment.
It's not often you get a Saturday Night Live skit made after something that you invent. So that's an accomplishment in itself. That means you made an impact.
Oh yeah, it made a lot of news. the ad that you're talking about, the little spoof that Saturday Night Live did, is they had a bottle of Crystal Pepsi being poured on some mashed potatoes and right. And it was like the gravy. And that was because we actually rushed it into the marketplace, and we had some parts of the country where it was a little cloudier than it should have been, and mm-hmm. We had quality control problems with it. It was just in my desire to get something done so fast, I really pushed the team too quickly, was a heat-seeking missile, and didn't listen to the really valid objections. And the big learning there that I had was, hey, if people bring up an issue, make sure you're really right if you decide that it's not an issue. Just don't mm-hmm. blow it off. I kind of blew it off. I didn't think they were as smart as me. I didn't think they got what I got. And it's like they just didn't get it. They wanted to have a lighter. I wanted to have a lighter cola flavor, not taste like Pepsi, because I wanted to bring in new users. And they told me it needed to have more Pepsi flavor notes, and they were right. And if I would have done that, I think I would have had a success. And if I wouldn't have rushed it in the market and we'd had better product quality, I think I'd had a success.
Well, and you certainly recovered from it, and it's now you can laugh about it. It's a legendary marketing story. So thanks for being willing to fill us in.
Oh, no, it's no problem. Yeah. Look, I think you learn it's okay to fail. You just can't do the same thing twice, and you need to learn from it when you do have a failure. And all the people that I talk to, everybody has sort of an epic fail. But the big thing is they learn from it, and they know that you're not going to get any innovation in your company if you don't let people take risks. So, mm-hmm. That's just the way it is.
So let's get you out of here with a few golf questions. We'll circle back to golf here and end on a few golf notes. With a little quick question here. Your favorite golf course. Can you name a favorite golf course? I guess you have to say Valhalla now, right?
Well, I think, I love Valhalla. Courses for different. I think I love Augusta National for the total experience.
Sure.
Okay. I love Cypress Point because of its raw beauty and just the nature that you can experience within that framework. I love Seminole because the course is phenomenal, but I love the membership. The membership there mm-hmm. is just, a bunch of golf fanatics, which is great. I love Shinnecock. I think probably the greatest pure golf course in the world. I don't think there's any course that's better than Shinnecock. I love National because it's so much fun to play, challenging, but fun, which is really great.
We're getting some goofy places there.
And then Pine Valley. Yeah. Pine Valley is, it's ranked by many as the number one golf course in the world. I don't know. It's like, people say it's 1A, B, C, D, everything has its own unique personality. Sorry for the long answer, but I can't give you one. And I love Valhalla. I love Valhalla because it is such a test of golf. It's got a lot of history very early on. And I I'm particularly excited about Valhalla because of what I know we're going to make it.
I'm sure. But I agree. It's a difficult question to answer because, what makes it your favorite? Is it because is it the hardest? Is it the most fun? Yeah. Is it the best experience? Is it, so I generally go with experience, and quality of golf course along with the experience tends to put things up in my rankings.
Well, as you listen to me describe those courses, there were unique things about each one of those courses that really makes it an experience.
Your lowest career low round.
Well, I had a 68 at Seminole, and when I was 68, I shot my age, birdied the last hole, and then this year I had a 69 at National, and I eagled the last hole to do it, number 18. Wow. So I was really exciting because once I made my 68, I really want to shoot my age until I die.
Did you know that you had to birdie the last hole for that 68? Yes. To shoot your age.
Oh, absolutely.
You're a scorecard keeper. Watcher.
I lipped out on 17 and I go, oh gosh, I had a great, I put a lot of pressure on myself on that last hole. And then 60, then I realized when I was at National, I had to birdie 17 and 18. It was in the four ball qualifier. to shoot my age. And I made a 30 footer on 17, and then I made a 35 footer on 18 for eagle. And so I don't know, it's just like, and that was the week after I won the Shinnecock Club Championship. So it was sort of like, it was my Walter Mitty week of golf. You know, yeah. You know, you never own golf. You can rent it for a while, but exactly. You know, right now I'm renting it at a very good price.
Good. How about, do you have a favorite podcast episode? One that stands out to you that you just say that was really cool or really fun?
Well, I had a blast doing a podcast with Tom Brady. I mean, he's just, he's probably the best leader I've ever really talked to in my life. I mean, he's so focused on learning and being great at what he does and, you know, building his team and leading his team. I particularly love that one. But, you know, my podcasts are kind of like my babies, you know, like I love every one of them. I learned something from each person. You know, I did a fantastic podcast, you know, with, you know, the chairman of Augusta National, mm-hmm. Fred Ridley, who had never done podcast before. And, you know, I love that one. In the golf world, I did one with Rory McIlroy. You know, I just did one. Yeah. Jack Nicklaus. And then I did one with John Rahm around the U.S. Open. He's my partner and the Seminole Pro member. So I've done people in the athletic world, which is always fun. But, you know, I've also done it with just a myriad of CEOs from JP Morgan Chase to Workday to Adobe, Twilio, you know, Ginkgo, BioWorks, you know, all kinds of different companies mm-hmm. and different leaders.
Well, I encourage everyone listening to this to start, subscribe to David's podcast, start listening to it. If you want to start with the golf episodes first, fine. You're going to learn something there, but you're going to learn something about leadership in these podcasts. I know I have. And today we learned about how important leadership is for us in the PGA professional world, you know, to help our industry, to be better leaders, to help our clubs. And we have David to thank for that today. So thanks for your time. This was really a treat for me, and I truly appreciate it.
I enjoyed it, Dean. You asked a lot of great questions, and it was a lot of fun. Good luck in your endeavors, and good luck to all the golf pros out there who I think just do a great job and enrich the lives of so many people. So thank you for everything you all are doing.
We appreciate that. Thanks, David.
Thank you for listening to the Getting Better Now podcast. For more information, go to golfbusinessnetwork.com.